Hi, thank you so much for joining us today on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. This is Modern Tech News. I'm Labiba, and today we have the honor and privilege of interviewing Dr. Stuart Hameroff, a well-known anesthesiologist with a very well-known interest in consciousness. His interest in consciousness has helped him start the Center for Consciousness Studies at the University of Arizona in 1998. Dr. Hameroff has written and edited 5 books and more than 100 scientific papers. In 2017, he published his most recent book, Consciousness and the Universe, Quantum Physics, Evolution, Brain, and Mind. The Center for Consciousness Studies will be hosting their biannual The Science of Consciousness Conference from April 18 to 22nd in Tucson, Arizona. In the second half of today's interview, Dr. Hameroff will describe the upcoming conference and list some of the keynote speakers at this hybrid event. But in the first part of today's interview, he will tell us why he founded the Center for Consciousness Studies, why he is doing research with ultrasound, and how ultrasound affects the brain. Then Dr. Hameroff will discuss some examples of ultrasound research that helps treat anxiety and has shown promise in treating Alzheimer's disease. If you listen to today's show, you will find out that the ultrasound research is successful because ultrasound helps resonate the microtubules, which are the internal scaffolding inside the cells. Dr. Hameroff will explain his fascination with microtubules and why he has researched them for almost 4 decades. Today's interview will describe also the famous quantum ORC, OR theory, which Dr. Stuart Hameroff developed with the renowned physicist and Nobel laureate Sir Roger Penrose. In their theory, they suggest that consciousness is a phenomena of quantum mechanics and that microtubules are the medium in which quantum mechanics takes place. We will start today's interview with a quote from a previous interview I had with Sir Roger Penrose on KZSU, in which he explains consciousness.
Consciousness itself is something which is not achieved by mere computation. So that's the position which I formulated, although I do have the belief that whatever is going on in our brains is in accordance with the laws of physics. So I'm not saying there's some mystical magic going on which suddenly ping and makes us understand things. I think that what the brain is doing is following physical laws just like everything else. But if it was following just the laws that we know now, these could be the laws of Newton, which tell us how particles move around, but then you can simulate that on a computer. They could be the laws of Schrödinger's quantum mechanics. You could simulate that on a computer, too. It would be difficult to do, and you might have to do it by approximations, and so there are issues about that. But basically, you could put these laws on a computer. It seems to me that there must be something missing in the laws of physics that we currently understand them. But what's missing? It has to be something which is very important in how physical things act, and the only gap that was obvious to me was this gap in how quantum mechanics works. So quantum mechanics somehow needs to become probabilistic after being completely deterministic, and that needs a change in the theory. So my argument had been that we need something going on in the brain which takes advantage of whatever is wrong with quantum mechanics.
What made you decide to develop the Center for Consciousness Studies at the University of Arizona?
The Center for Consciousness Studies at the University of Arizona grew out of the first 2 conferences we held in the early 90s. In 1994, along with some colleagues, I organized the first interdisciplinary international conference on consciousness. Prior to that, as you know, consciousness had kind of disappeared from science during the first half of the 20th century, because you can't measure it, and the behaviorists didn't want to deal with it. So it was kind of taboo. And then in the 80s, books by prominent people like Francis Crick, Gerald Edelman, And Roger Penrose brought consciousness into public view and discussion, and it became more acceptable. And then Dan Dennett wrote also a book kind of discrediting the idea that consciousness was anything special. But there were meetings on various aspects, but no interdisciplinary meeting bringing all different approaches together.
Penrose is physics. What were the other people?
We had neuroscience, philosophy, cognitive science, math, physics, experiential approaches, even some parapsychology and meditation. And the mistake we made in the first conference was to have each of those topics on a different day. The barriers were hard to fall. But the good thing was the first morning was philosophy. And the first two speakers were traditional philosophers who were kind of boring, and the audience was falling asleep. And then the third speaker was David Chalmers, who is now famous, but was then unknown. And he got up and pranced around and talked about the hard problem of consciousness, how easy problems like memory, attention, reportability, behavior were relatively easy compared to the nature of existence, of qualia, of phenomenal experience. And how could we explain that? That was the hard problem. He's a very dynamic guy and kind of looked like a rock star prancing up and down. And people got all excited. And at the coffee break, everybody was talking about the hard problem. So that kind of galvanized the movement right then and there. And the rest of the conference, we had some great speakers, Christoph Koch, Benjamin Libet, Roger Penrose is there, many others. And I didn't intend to do another conference, but people wanted one, and I encouraged others to do it, but it didn't come together. There were polar opposites. So we decided to do another one in 2 years. In the interim year, somebody organized one with our collaboration in Italy. And so we started alternating in even-numbered years with Tucson, odd-numbered years elsewhere around the world. And after the second conference, we moved downtown to the convention center, and it was much bigger. We had like 1,000 people, got a lot of publicity. And after that, the Fetzer Institute approached us and suggested that they would fund a Center for Consciousness Studies if we were to continue the conferences and develop consciousness studies as an interdisciplinary field. And so we did that. And with Al Kasniak, Al Scott, and Jim Laukas, we started the Center for Consciousness Studies, funded by the Fetzer Institute and approved by the Arizona Board of Regents as an official center at the University of Arizona. And Dave Chalmers came back to become the second director. Al Kasniak was the first director and stayed for 5 years. And we continued to have the conferences. Then he left and I became the director in 2004. And I've been the director ever since. And we've continued. And now we're coming up on, the 29th annual conference. And the center has expanded and blossomed a little bit into other areas, including education. We're now sponsoring and organizing undergraduate and hopefully graduate level courses in consciousness studies. This is headed by Tom Bever, a Regents professor, and areas of research, including my own, that I hope we'll talk about, Tom's, and also Jay Sanguinetti, who is a psychologist studying transcranial ultrasound for brain modulation, which has become very popular. So we have three areas now, the conferences, education, and research.
Great. So tell us about the undergraduate courses.
Tom Bever has been organizing those. And the first course was called Consciousness and Spirituality. It's been a seminar course with a lot of different speakers. And I've given a couple lectures in each of the first 2 years. And I'll give another one this year when it starts up, one by myself, and then another one with my friend and colleague, Dante Loretta, who is an astronomer who is looking for the origin of life in asteroids. He's the head of a NASA mission that went to an asteroid and scooped up carbonaceous material and is bringing it back to Earth next year, year and a half from now, and we'll be looking for organic molecules. And he thinks, as do I, that will also be the origin of consciousness. So we were just discussing actually how we're going to analyze these samples to see, they're very similar to the organic molecules in aromatic amino acids and biology on Earth, and what was apparently present in the primordial soup. So we think that might be the origin of consciousness and life. So that's another area that we're getting into, is the origin of life and consciousness in astronomy.
Do you think the undergraduate students who take this course will be able to participate in some of these experiments?
Well, perhaps. Right now, the student orientation is mostly with Jay's lab on transcranial ultrasound. In about 2010, I met a guy named Anirban Bandyopadhyay, an Indian scientist working in Japan, and he had been following the work I'd been doing with Roger Penrose on microtubules, and he liked it very much. He's a material scientist and a nanotechnologist and started studying microtubules and with nanotechnology and was looking for quantum properties in microtubules and found that microtubules have coherent resonances in certain frequencies that were cell similar, starting in at the high end, terahertz, 10 to the 12th hertz, also gigahertz, 10 to the 9th, megahertz, 10 to the 6th, kilohertz, 10 to the 3, and also hertz. So every three orders of magnitude, he would see these patterns of resonance. And what he did was he used nanoprobes, like four nanoprobes on a microtubule, two to stimulate and two to record from. And at most frequencies, they're insulators. They don't conduct. But he found critical frequencies at which they became highly conductive. He couldn't say superconductive, but you know, ballistic conductance, because there was some resistance at the tip. But they became ballistic conductance and possibly quantum resonance at very specific frequencies. And each of these had a particular pattern, a triplet of triplets, which repeated every three orders of magnitude. So when he showed me this work, I was very excited. And I realized that microtubules had all these resonant frequencies. And I began to wonder how we could take advantage of this if microtubules were doing in the brain what I thought they were doing, basically mediating consciousness, how we could treat consciousness, mental and cognitive disorders with some of these modalities. Well, terahertz is visible, and that's kind of hard to get into the brain. Gigahertz is microwaves, and I wasn't interested in putting microwaves into the brain. And then megahertz was radio waves. I wasn't interested in that either. But megahertz in mechanical vibrations is ultrasound. And I was very familiar with ultrasound because we use it in anesthesiology, and we use it all the time for imaging. I knew it was pretty safe, and I discovered it had been approved for brain imaging, wasn't used because MRI and CT and what were so much better, but was still used in newborns looking for strokes through the fontanelle where there's no skull. So I figured, well, it couldn't be that harmful. And I found that including somebody at Arizona State University had been studying effects of ultrasound in the brain of animals and seeing physiological and behavioral responses. And so I said to my anesthesia colleagues, I'm an anesthesiologist, that's my day job, and I'm still doing it, and still enjoying it, actually, after all these years, but that's another story. So I said to my colleagues, we should try ultrasound into the brain of patients who are depressed.
Hi, you're listening to KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our guest today is Dr. Stuart Hameroff, who founded the Center for Consciousness Studies at the University of Arizona. Dr. Hameroff is famous for the theory that consciousness originates from quantum states in neural microtubules. He advocated this theory and still advocates it with the physicist and Nobel laureate Dr. Roger Penrose. And in the next section, Dr. Stuart Hameroff will explain what microtubules are and why he believes consciousness originates in the quantum states of neural microtubules.
All cells, all eukaryotic cells, have a structural basis inside of them, which they need unless they're perfectly spherical. They call it part of the cytoskeleton, the skeleton of the cell. So just like our bones support the asymmetry of our body, cells have a cytoskeleton made of filamentous proteins that define its shape. And neurons are the most asymmetrical cells, so they have the most elaborate cytoskeleton because they're very long in axons, and even dendrites are long and so forth. The cytoskeleton includes microtubules, which I'll describe in a minute, actin protein, intermediate filaments, and other structures like centrioles, cilia, flagella, and so forth. Microtubules are cylindrical polymers of a protein called tubulin. Tubulin is a peanut-shaped protein, and they self-assemble. If you put enough tubulins in the right mixture of calcium and magnesium, not too much calcium, they will self-assemble into these cylindrical polymers that can be very long. And they form these structures, and then these structures actually are essential for many things, including cell division, mitosis, separating chromosomes, establishing cell shape in neurons, forming synapses, generating axons and dendrites by self-assembling and growing. They seemed, when I started studying them back in medical school in the 70s, they seemed to have some sort of intelligence, how they divided the chromosomes in mitosis, and how they made synapses and so forth.
Where and how did you study the microtubules in the 70s?
I spent a summer research elective in a cancer lab studying malignancy, cancer. We were all looking at mitosis, cell divisions. So in cell division, the chromosomes replicate. And so you have two of each chromosomes. And then one set, 23, need to go to one daughter cell and the other to the other. And how did that happen? Well, these structures called centrioles, which are made of microtubules, sent out these mitotic spindles, they're called, which are microtubules. And each one would grab one particular chromosome. They'd pick one of each of the chromosomes on one side and one of each on the other and pull them apart. And then the two would, there'd be a boundary and you'd have two daughter cells with identical sets of chromosomes. So that was mitosis. And back then, genetic engineering was just at the dawn of becoming very important. And everybody else in the lab became really interested in the chromosomes and the genes. But I, for some reason, got very interested in these microtubules and how they knew where to go and what to do and how they orchestrated this delicate dance it was of organizing the chromosomes and pulling them apart. I remember thinking they must have some sort of intelligence. I wasn't thinking of consciousness yet, but some sort of intelligence to know what to do and perform and do this choreography in real time. It was fortuitous because at the same time in the early 70s, a couple other things happened. The structure of microtubules became known. I remember looking at the first crystallographic evidence from Amos and Klug of microtubules, and they were these cylinders of these peanut-shaped proteins with a Fibonacci geometry. So if you follow the winding pattern, there are three winding patterns, 3, 5, and 8, and then you could find 13 and 21. So they had I knew about the Fibonacci series, so that was interesting, but they were a lattice. And at the same time, computers were pretty new to me, and I started looking at, you know, how computers worked and, you know, Boolean switching matrices and some kind of logic circuits and some kind of grid patterns. And I thought, well, maybe microtubules are like little computers and process information and knew what to do and where to go and so forth. The other thing that happened right at the same time was that a guy named Keith Porter at Harvard, who was an electron microscopist, had been looking at cell interiors with the electron microscope and using a fixative agent called osmium tetroxide to fixate the cell for EM. And it turned out that osmium tetroxide was dissolving all the microtubules and all the internal structure of the cell. So at that time, it looked like inside of the cell was like a minestrone soup of things swimming around and with no solid state, all these structures just floating around. And then he tried a new fixative agent called glutaraldehyde. And all of a sudden he saw all the structure. And he saw these microtubules and all this solid state structure inside cells, including neurons. And at first people said, no, that's an artifact. But then he persisted. It turned out that the minestrone soup idea was an artifact. And so the cytoskeleton was discovered in neurons. So my real interest was in consciousness. And I realized that neurons were full of these microtubules, which looked and acted like computers. So maybe they had something to do with consciousness. I got really interested in that and I started to study and became somewhat obsessed by them. And as you can tell, I still am after all these years. And I thought about doing a research career, but I was finishing medical school and I wanted to move out west. I came to Tucson, Arizona because I wanted to live here and found an internship. And I said, well, I'll figure out what to do later. And I stumbled into anesthesiology because a man named Burnell Brown, the chairman of the anesthesia department at a brand new medical school, University of Arizona, was in need of residents. And we met and he said, why don't you go into anesthesia? If you figure out how anesthesia works, you can understand consciousness. He showed me a paper that anesthesia caused microtubules to depolymerize. And that was thought to be a mechanism of anesthesia, although it turned out took about five times as much anesthesia to cause depolymerization as it does to cause anesthesia. But it showed that anesthesia affects microtubules. And he said, it's a lot of fun and it's pretty good money. So I said, okay. And he said, and you can have an academic career and study consciousness and anesthesia and microtubules. So that's what I did. And here I am almost 50 years later.
Okay. So microtubules are the same for all people.
Well, not exactly. Well, they are quite similar in all eukaryotic cells. So from very simple organisms up to us in all animals. However, they differ in a lot of ways. For example, even the microtubules in your body and my body are different in that the microtubules in our brains have, for example, 22 different isozymes. So each tubulin can be one of 22 different genetic tubulins. overall similar, but slightly different. And then they can be modified. Whereas in other cells, there's only 10 or 11 isozymes. So the brain has more varied microtubules than do other cells. So yes, they're the same, but at a fine detail, they're quite different. And also in neurons, they're arranged completely differently than they are in all other cells. They have a polarity. They have a plus end and a minus end. And in most cells, the plus end is in towards the nucleus or the centrosome, and the minus end is outward toward the cell peripherally, like the spokes of a wheel. And that's how in axons, they're also unipolar. All the pluses and minuses are at the same end. But in dendrites and cell bodies of neurons, they're interrupted. In other words, instead of being continuous, as you would want the bones of your body to be in the skeleton, they were broken and interrupted, and even stranger, in mixed polarity. So instead of being plus end out, minus end in, or the other way around, they would be mixed. They're in mixed polarity, anti-parallel networks. And nobody's ever explained why that is. And Roger Penrose and I, I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, suggested that that gives rise to interference in quantum beats, like in music, where you get interference between two instruments that are slightly out of tune, you get beats at lower frequencies. And that would explain going from terahertz to gigahertz to megahertz to kilohertz to hertz and EEG. And for example, EEG could be coming from quantum beats of microtubules.
Do you think microtubules help store memory?
They can store memory. They're perfectly suited to store memory. Most people say memory is in the synapses, but the synaptic proteins only last hours to days, and memories can last a lifetime. And the microtubules and dendrites and cell bodies of neurons are capped. Neurons don't divide, so they don't have to disassemble and reformulate as mitotic spindles. They can just stay as microtubules and store memory for a lifetime in principle. So we think they store memory, and we think that consciousness happens in the same information medium where memory is stored, which would make it very convenient.
Hi, you're listening to KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Thank you for joining us today for our show about consciousness and microtubules with our guest, Dr. Stuart Hameroff, who is a professor of anesthesiology and psychology and director of the Center for Consciousness Studies at the University of Arizona. Dr. Hameroff became interested in the intelligent behavior of microtubules because they organize the activities within the living cells. Are microtubules arranged in different ways for different kinds of people? For example, monks who meditate, do they have certain arrangements of their microtubules?
We don't know that for sure. We know that meditating monks have higher gamma synchrony frequencies, their EEG tends to be higher frequency, and that probably goes all the way down to the kilohertz, megahertz, gigahertz, and terahertz might be shifted to higher frequency. We know that in Alzheimer's disease, where people lose memory and lose cognition, that the microtubules are disrupted, that most people look at Alzheimer's as the amyloid plaques that are outside the neurons, whereas what really correlates with the cognitive dysfunction are the neurofibrillary tangles inside the neurons, where the tau, which is a microtubule-associated protein and stabilizes microtubules, are dislodged from the microtubules and form these neurofibrillary tangles, and the microtubules disassemble. When that happens, the neuron loses length and you lose synapses, and that's Alzheimer's disease. So,
do we know why that happens?
We don't know whether the tau falls off first and gets hyperphosphorylated, or whether the microtubules disassemble and the tau has nowhere else to go. So we don't know which comes first. A recent study just came out showing that ultrasound, which is what I was talking about before, which can resonate microtubules in megahertz, seems to be good at treating Alzheimer's. And this is a study that we've been wanting to do. So what I was talking about before was using ultrasound into the brain, hopefully to resonate microtubules to improve mood, which it clearly does. Several studies have shown that. Possibly improve Alzheimer's and anxiety and all kinds of stuff. That if consciousness depends on microtubules, then resonating the microtubules can stabilize them, grow them, and make you happier and smarter, hopefully.
Is this something similar to electric shocks?
No. Electroconvulsive therapy causes a grand mal seizure. And we actually anesthetize patients so they can have this. It does work. It treats depression. But no, this ultrasound to the brain is completely painless. You don't feel it at all. You don't feel anything for about a minute, in my experience. And then you start to get a little bit of a buzz and feel good and lasts for a while. And, you know, there are a number of modalities of brain modulation. Transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS, has been around for a while. Transcranial electrical stimulation, alternating current and direct current, and photons. And ultrasound came along later, but a recent paper by the editor of the journal Brain Stimulation came out and said, well, ultrasound is now the predominant therapeutic mode for non-invasive brain modulation. And so I think it's just going to get bigger and bigger. Just new papers are coming out all the time showing its benefit for anxiety and depression and things like that.
You mentioned you tried it. How long does the effect last?
Well, I was telling the story when I told my colleagues we should try it on our chronic pain patients. And one of them said, yeah, right. We tried on ourselves first. Your idea, you got a shaved head, go ahead. So they kind of challenged me and called my bluff. We were sitting around this table in the OR lounge at the end of a day, and there's an ultrasound machine, and I've been thinking about trying it. So I took the machine and you got to put this gel on, and I held it up to my head right here, and I turned it on for about 15 seconds. I put it down, and I didn't feel anything, and I was kind of disappointed. I said, oh, I don't feel anything. But about a minute later, I started to feel really good, energized, calm, kind of serene. And it lasted for an hour, maybe 2 hours. And I said, okay, we're going to do a study. So we did a double blind. Because you can't feel it, it's easy to do a double blind study. We went to our chronic pain clinic and went to people who had chronic pain and were depressed. And all we measured then was a mood scale. It was double blind and mood and pain. We did about 30 patients, and we found a significant increase in mood and an almost significant decrease in pain in these pain patients. And we published it in the journal Brain Stimulation, which was a good journal. It's a pilot study. That was the first study of transcranial ultrasound, trans across the skull ultrasound. It has different names now, focused ultrasound, transcranial focus, but it's basically brain ultrasound. And it's become more and more popular. And as Mark George, the editor of Brain Stimulation, said, it's now the predominant and most promising mode for non-invasive modulation. And my colleague Jay Sanguinetti has been doing the lead work here at the University of Arizona. And we had a paper not too long ago showing increased mood and by fMRI, increased connectivity. So it actually increased brain connections throughout certain parts of the brain. And he and his colleague Shinzen Young are looking at inducing mindfulness by targeting a specific part of the brain. And you can do it as kind of a shotgun, the whole brain, which is what I did with the ultrasound at first, but you can also focus it at specific target areas. And the Alzheimer's paper, they targeted the hippocampus, for example, and got a good result.
What is a good result?
Their cognition improves significantly.
For how long?
For as long as they measured it, which I can't remember. I can send you the paper. And
so does that mean that different diseases have the microtubules arranged in certain ways?
That seems to be the case in schizophrenia, that the microtubules are not organized properly in the dendrites of the pyramidal cells. And I should add that I think the layer 5 pyramidal cells are probably the most important for consciousness. They have the largest arrays of mixed polarity microtubules. And that's where they looked for schizophrenia. So whether it works for schizophrenia or not, I don't know. But it seems to work for depression. It seems to work for anxiety. Early results are very favorable for Alzheimer's.
What are some of the experiments that you did in this area?
We did a pilot study. You got to be a little bit careful because ultrasound can be used at several intensities. It can be used at a very high intensity to heat the brain and cause lesions. If you want to get rid of a tumor or you want to get rid of a seizure focus, that quite literally burns the brain. We're not interested in that. Then you can use it at a middle dose to open the blood-brain barrier to get drug molecules in that wouldn't otherwise get in. We don't want to open the blood-brain barrier. We're at a very low intensity, and the recent paper that just came out is also at low intensity. So it doesn't cause heating. We're very careful about that. It's low intensity, and officially the mechanism is unknown. People say it causes the membrane to deflect. But it's looking more and more to me anyway, of course, I am biased, that it's affecting microtubules. If you look at ultrasound effects on individual cells, it causes them to sprout out neuronal cells, neurites, and so forth. It's having that kind of effect. You know, we hope to do studies to pinpoint the mechanism, but I'd bet pretty good money that it's acting on microtubules.
How will you be able to prove it?
We're going to do laboratory studies and just study ultrasound effects on microtubules. We're already doing some very interesting laboratory studies on microtubules, looking for quantum optical effects. We got funded by the Templeton Foundation as part of their program, Accelerating Research in Consciousness. They wanted us to show quantum effects in microtubules and then have them go away with anesthesia inside an animal that was moving around. And we said, well, the first part needs to be done first because it's already complicated enough. Templeton gave us money to do the experiments, basically to take just microtubules in a cuvette or a test tube or a petri dish, demonstrate quantum effects. And if we find them, then try anesthesia and see if anesthesia affects them, takes it away. And so we set up experiments in two different labs. One is at Princeton in the lab of Greg Scholes, who's a very prominent quantum biologist, who did some of the early work on quantum biology of photosynthesis protein, showing that photosynthesis uses quantum coherence. And Arat Kalra, who is a postdoc who came from Jack Chasinski's lab at University of Alberta, and he'd been working on this previously. So Arat went to Princeton and set up these experiments, and he was looking at tryptophan fluorescence lifetimes in tubulin and microtubules, and he found an effect of a quantum coupling in the microtubule from putting in the photons and a label called AMCA, and then he put in the anesthetic and it went away. So he showed an effect of anesthesia dampening a quantum effect in microtubules with a soluble anesthetic and also a gas anesthetic.
Tell us the significance of that.
Let me back up a little bit. So after I got obsessed with microtubules, I spent a lot of time modeling them as computers, working with physicists and engineers, Rich Watton and Steen Rasmussen, who is at Los Alamos. And Steen did the best work in modeling microtubules as automata, like cellular automata, whereas instead of each individual unit being a cell, which is already gigantic and too huge, each individual unit was a tubulin. And originally we were thinking, well, it changes its conformation. And that turns out to be a problem. But the point is that each tubulin could be one bit, as opposed to the whole cell being a bit. Most people think of the brain as a complex computer of simple neurons, but each neuron is incredibly complex. And that view is an insult to neurons, because neurons are very complicated, and single cell organisms that are just one cell, like a paramecium, can swim around, find food, find a mate, have sex, learn, escape from a capillary tube, and it's just one cell, and it uses its microtubules, its cilia.
So how many microtubules does this organism have?
Paramecium, most neurons have about a billion tubulins. So it depends how many microtubules that is. A paramecium is probably less, you know, millions. So that would be the number of bits. And it uses them somehow to be for clever. I'm not saying they're conscious. They could be. So Steen and I and others modeled microtubules as these automata where each tubulin could be a one or a zero. And we showed that they could process information. And if you connected two of them together using the Hamming distance, we showed that they could learn. And so we demonstrated that in principle, they could process information. And I went around to a lot of neural net meetings and AI meetings in the 80s, where Hans Moravec and then later Kurzweil, the singularity, were saying, well, there's 10 to the 11th neurons in the brain. Each one has about 1,000 synapses. They operate at about 100 hertz. That gives 10 to the 16th operations per second. So when we have a computer that can do 10 to the 16th operations per second, it will be equivalent to the brain and, you know, we'll have consciousness in our computer. You know, I thought that was kind of very naive for a number of reasons. But one reason was, if you look at a neuron, it has about a billion tubulins, and and it was switching its much faster, 10 megahertz. So that gives you 10 to the 16th operations per second in every neuron. And then you'd have to multiply by the number of neurons. So I was going around to neural net and AI meetings being kind of a pain, saying, you know, you're treating the neuron as one bit. There's actually 10 to the 16th bits per second or operations per second in every neuron. So your goalpost is way, way, way downfield, even if that's all there is to it, pure computation. So they didn't like that very much. And they kind of ignored me and said, ah, you're crazy. Go away. You bother me and whatnot. But then one day at one of these meetings, somebody said to me, and I don't know who, I can't remember who it was, but I'm very grateful to this person, said, okay, wise guy, and let's say you're right, and there's all this information, how would that explain consciousness? Because I was claiming it was underlying consciousness. And I realized that he was right, that, and this later became known as the hard problem that Dave Chalmers elucidated. Others had elucidated in different ways before, but how do you get from computation and information processing to feelings, love, joy, emotion, all this consciousness, awareness, phenomenal experience, qualia, whatever you want to call it. It's still even hard to describe. I said, you know, I don't know. I was kind of stunned. I realized I was a reductionist and I didn't have an answer. But fortunately, this person suggested, he said, you should read a book called The Emperor's New Mind by Roger Penrose. And so I did. And I was blown away by it. It was an incredible book. It first argued that consciousness is not computation, that there was something non-computable. Because, for example, he used Gödel's theorem and said that, and according to Gödel's theorem, a mathematical proof can't prove itself. You have to be outside the system to know whether it's true or not. So you need a conscious mathematician or some other system to know that a theorem is true or not. He said, and similarly, brain computation isn't enough to know something. And he used understanding. Understanding is a feeling. And to understand something, to understand that a theorem is true or not, you need something else. You need this non-computable effect. I said, okay, that kind of makes sense. And John Searle had a similar argument from the Chinese room argument that I was familiar with. But Roger went one step further and he said, well, okay, where do we get this non-computable effect? He said, for that, we need to go to yet another mystery, that is the measurement problem in quantum mechanics, collapse of the wave function. So as you may know, in quantum mechanics, small things can be superposition of multiple states or locations at the same time. But when they're measured or observed, they collapse to one or the other. At least that's how it seemed. So the early quantum pioneers claimed that conscious observation caused collapse of the wave function. That solved their problem. Bohr, as Niels Bohr said, it doesn't matter what the underlying reality is. We can develop quantum mechanics, which they did, fortunately, because it's fantastic. The electronics we're using now all depends on it, and so forth. But it didn't really explain what was actually going on. And Schrodinger thought this was absurd and used, you know, came up with his thought experiment of Schrodinger's cat, of a fate of a cat being tied to a quantum event outside. He said, according to this interpretation, the cat is both dead and alive until somebody opens the box and takes a look. You know, it still hasn't been solved. Why can't we see superpositions? For example, one is that, well, there's no collapse and each possibility continues and we have multiple worlds, infinite number of multiple universes, and there's decoherence, but that doesn't really explain it. It just kind of buries it in noise. And Roger came up with a completely different idea based on an objective reduction, that there was some threshold at which a superposition would collapse to one or the other. He first explained how a superposition could exist. How can something be in two places at once? And to do this, he related to general relativity. And this is what I read in this book. And I was like, wow, this guy is way beyond everybody else coming up with it. Because Einstein had shown the equivalence between mass and curvature in space-time and predicted that light behind the sun would be curved so we could see it on Earth. And this experiment was done by Eddington during an eclipse, and he saw stars that were known to be behind the sun because the mass of the sun caused space-time curvature, and he could see it. So that proved that for very large things. So Roger applied the same idea to very small things. He said, well, a tiny quantum particle is a tiny curvature in space-time geometry. And if it's here, it's a curvature this way. If it's here, it's a curvature that way. So what you have is a separation in space-time geometry. And you can imagine that if each of these possibilities continued, you'd get many worlds. And that would happen again and again. And you have an infinite number of overlapping coexisting universes. But Roger said, no, these separations are unstable. And after a time t given by basically the uncertainty principle, a variety of the uncertainty principle, they would collapse to one or the other based on the magnitude of the superposition. And this was the kicker. And when that happened, that would produce a moment of conscious experience or proto-conscious experience if it was random. So he had a mechanism, number one, to explain superposition, number two, to explain the measurement problem, and three, to generate consciousness or its precursor, proto-consciousness. So I said, wow, you know, to go out on these limbs, and yet there wasn't anything wrong with it. And there weren't any other explanations that I could see. To this day, I haven't heard of any other explanation for the origin of consciousness other than the self-collapse of the wave function, of the space-time geometry collapsing to one or the other, producing consciousness. It was completely opposite to the effect, to the what was called the Copenhagen interpretation from Niels Bohr, that conscious observation caused collapse of the wave function. In this case, collapse of the wave function occurred spontaneously and caused consciousness, or was equivalent to consciousness. So I contacted Roger and we met. I told him about microtubules. He was looking for a quantum computer in the brain and didn't really know what was available. He liked the idea. We teamed up. We started collaborating. We became good friends. You know, that was the early 90s and we're still good friends. As you know, he won the Nobel Prize for black holes, continues to be very interested in consciousness, has been on all the Zoom meetings we've been having about the quantum effects in the microtubules and effects of anesthetics. He will be speaking at the conference coming up in April. So our theory, after being ridiculed by almost everybody, is doing pretty well, thank you. I'm very pleased.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us today on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our guest today is Dr. Stuart Hameroff, who is well known for his interest in consciousness and who collaborated in the 1990s with Sir Roger Penrose to come up with the ORC-OR quantum theory of consciousness. Sir Roger Penrose published this theory in 1994 in his book, Shadows of the Mind. I had the privilege of interviewing Sir Roger Penrose a few years ago, and here is how he outlined his collaboration with Dr. Hameroff and outlined the ORC-OR theory.
Stuart Hameroff wrote to me and said, you may not appreciate these substructures of neurons. I didn't see how neurons could do it, because a neuron signal would disturb the environment of the brain and essentially the quantum coherence would get completely lost. But Stuart Hameroff explained, well, you may not know about these structures. They're called microtubules. They're in pretty well all cells in the body. He believed they had a particular role to play in neurons, and we should really understand about them if I'm going to think about where there could be a quantum mechanical processes going on a bigger scale. So I tried to understand more about microtubules, because I'd never heard of microtubules. And then he explained to me these structures were very crystalline in appearance. I mean, this is not like a real crystal, because you're looking at proteins instead of atoms, molecules. And I was aware of the fact that if you have symmetries of this kind, that there's a much better chance of preserving quantum effects at a large scale. So it was partly the symmetry which appealed to me. Partly, yes, indeed, these are much smaller than neurons. They're tubes also, so there's a reasonable chance that you might be able to shield some kind of activity going on inside the tubes and preserve some kind of coherence. So they look like a much better bet than anything I'd seen before. So we got together and after several months and years produced a scheme which we've been working on ever since, which we refer to the ORC-OR scheme. ORC, O-R-C-H, stands for orchestrated, and OR stands for objective reduction. Reduction stands for what happens when the quantum state. You see, if you follow the Schrodinger equation, the quantum state suddenly jumps to something else, according to the way we do it. When you make a measurement, it makes the quantum state jump. Schrodinger didn't like that at all. Once he objected to this idea and got rather depressed about his own equation. But this is the way we have to treat quantum mechanics, is this very curious jumps that seem to happen. It's called the reduction of the quantum state, or the collapse of the wave function. What I'm trying to say is this reduction, that's the R in OR. O stands for objective. So I'm saying that it's happening out there in the world as an objective phenomenon. It's not somehow imposed upon the world by somebody looking at it. And I like OR because it's a nice acronym. It stands for OR. So it says either or A happens or B happens. So when OR takes place, it means that the superposition between A and B now becomes A or B. And this is an objective thing which happens in the world at a certain level. And this happens in the brain. It has to be organized in a way which is orchestrated, is the word we use, that somehow the brain is set up in such a way that these objective reductions take place in a coherent way. And these microtubules, the estimate about how soon does this reduction take place, the quantum state would have to be lots and lots of microtubules. There are many, many microtubules in one neuron, but you'd have to have them also being coherent from neuron to neuron in some way. So the scheme is pretty wild in many ways. You say, how could you have a scheme which was quantum mechanical to this extent? I accept it's a challenge.
Please tell us about this year's The Science of Consciousness Conference. It's in April?
April 18th through 22nd, and it's a hybrid. We have several hundred people coming and maybe another couple thousand online. So we have a tremendous lineup. Monday is workshops, like four parallel workshops. And then Tuesday is the plenary session on the brain mostly. The first is anesthesia and wakefulness and sleep and so forth. The keynote is Christoph Koch, a very famous neuroscientist. Tuesday evening is the welcome party, and then we're going to have a dialogue between Deepak Chopra and Sue Blackmore. Sue Blackmore is an arch-materialist, and Deepak is an idealist. And they had a debate in 2012 and kind of got into a fight. So we're going to bring them back for a rematch. But they're good friends now. And then psychedelics. The keynote is Robin Carhart-Harris, who spoke at the 2012 conference and gave an amazing talk. They had studied patients on psilocybin in an MRI scanner in the EEG with their eyes closed and just resting. And they were having vivid psilocybin type experiences. Yet surprisingly, their MRI was cold and dark. It looked like they were almost unconscious and their EEG was nearly flat. This is still a mystery. And what I think is that, and what I told Robin is that consciousness really comes from the quantum level inside neurons in the microtubules. What takes energy is the membrane and neurons firing. So if consciousness stays deep and you're not doing anything, you're not interacting with the environment, it's all inside here, it's very low energy. And in fact, that's very similar to near-death experiences. When the blood stops flowing and the energy goes away, in fact, Mink Chawla, who's done work in this area, just sent me this amazing paper where they actually recorded in-depth EEG in somebody as they died and show very high frequency gamma synchrony, very pure gamma, which Mink Chawla had correlated with the out-of-body experience. So I think that's kind of like psychedelics. The membranes are not functioning. You don't need them in psychedelics and they're unable to function in your death experience. What's happening is that consciousness is strictly at a deeper level, quantum level in the microtubules. Now, I can't prove that, but that's what I think. And it seems to make sense. And then in the afternoon, we have some talks on mechanisms of psychedelics, what they actually do, how they actually work. Most people say, well, they act on serotonin receptors, but I think they probably also act on microtubules. Now, those are other experiments. We want to look at the effects of the psychedelics, which all have these aromatic rings, which can have quantum optical modalities on the quantum optics of microtubules. Thursday, the keynote speaker is Avi Loeb from Harvard, who is really into extraterrestrial life and consciousness. And he's going to talk about consciousness in the universe, actually, and what he thinks are evidence for signals from extraterrestrials and so forth. And we'll have a session on the origin of life. And my friend Dante Loretta, who I'm working with on the origin of life and consciousness on these molecules, and another good friend of mine, Steen Rasmussen, who I worked with back in the 80s and 90s on microtubule automata, we'll be talking about origin of life along with Sarah Walker from Arizona State University. That's Thursday. And then Friday, we'll have a session on time with Paul Davies, Daniel Sheehan, and Roger Penrose. We'll talk about his backward time effects, which you need to be able to react in real time and enable free will. Thursday night is the dinner, conference dinner, and we're going to have a talk before that by Paulo Roberto Souza da Silva, who is the head of the Church of Saint Dame in Brazil, the Ayahuasca Church. And he'll be talking about ayahuasca, the Amazon brew that is hallucinogenic that they use for religious purposes in Brazil. And then Friday, the keynote speaker is Dave Chalmers, who will be talking about his new book, Reality Plus, in which he's talking about whether reality is a simulation and whether our consciousness is all a simulation of some entity, a godlike entity that is manipulating or kind of like the Matrix. The Matrix meets the metaverse is the name of his talk. And his book is causing a lot of stir. Dave says, you know, he doesn't necessarily believe it. Could be a 25% possibility, but Dave always dabbles. He was a functionalist. He was a panpsychist. He's an AI guy. Now he's into quantum and he's into this simulation idea. And then Friday afternoon, the last plenary is going to be really interesting, I think. I was at a conference early February at Google, organized by my friend Hartmut Nevin, who's the head of Google's quantum AI. He's the one who led Google's efforts in quantum supremacy and showed that quantum computers can do things that others can't. And this was a big deal. And now Google and Microsoft and everybody's getting into quantum computers because they're coming online. And Hartmut's been coming to our consciousness conference for a long, long time. He had this conference with Christoph Koch, of all people, who was very much against the quantum idea and very much against stuff inside the neurons being relevant. But he's considering it now. So they organized a conference called Quantum Neuroscience at Google that I was privileged to attend. Anyway, the last session will be on the outcome from that quantum neuroscience conference. So Hartmut will speak, Arad Kara will speak, and then Travis Craddock will speak about super radiance and other explanations for these quantum effects in microtubules. And then we have evening concurrence and posters. And then Friday night, we end with the traditional poetry slam, zombie blues, which is always fun. People get up and give poems about consciousness, and people sing renditions of the zombie blues, which is something that Dave and I came up with along with a guy named Pradeep many years ago at one of our conferences, and we have a good time.
Hi, you're listening to KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Thank you for joining us for our interview with Dr. Stuart Hameroff, who just described his upcoming conference, the Science of Consciousness Conference, which will take place from April 18 to 22nd.
First day is workshops of all different topics, three or four speakers in each workshop, and then 4 days of plenary with a keynote in each speaker. And the website is www.consciousness.arizona.edu, and you can get everything you need from that.
How long did it take you to organize this conference?
I've been doing it a long time, and I have a tremendous assistant, Abby Behar Montefiore. And I have a great program committee, George Mashour, who is another anesthesiologist at the University of Michigan. He kind of keeps me honest, doesn't let me go too much into the microtubules and let other people have their say. And Tom Bever, Jay Sanguinetti, Betsy Bigby, and Abby, and Dante Loretta, and Bruce McIver, who's a pharmacologist. You know, we invite the plenary speakers. We open it for abstract submissions, and we have a couple hundred parallel session speakers and posters and exhibits and art shows. And Abby takes care of all the arrangements. It's hybrid, but the live event will be at Lowe's Ventana Canyon Resort, which is a beautiful eco lodge in the desert, in the hills above Tucson. It's beautiful. And you can hike up into the mountains from there, and it's very natural and in nature. It's kind of isolated, and people just hang out there and have a great time.
The Science of Consciousness Conference is organized by the Center for Consciousness Studies. It will take place from April 18 to 22nd, and the website is consciousness.arizona.edu. And before leaving Dr. Stuart Hameroff, we wanted to know about his latest experiments on microtubules.
Well, the work we've been doing now is showing the quantum optical effects, super radiance in microtubules. We showed an effect, a dampening with anesthesia, and there's anesthetics that are soluble that you can give intravenous. You can use in a liquid form. We did one study with a gas, but we did that in its liquid form. We want to do this in the gas phase. So the system at Central Florida that RST has can be put in a chamber, like a plexiglass chamber in air, and the microtubule can actually be sitting on a surface in air. We can be measuring its quantum optical effects, its super radiance and so forth. And so it's in air, and then we have a gas coming in and gas coming out, slow as to not disturb anything. And we could put a vaporizer. You know, I'm an anesthesiologist, so I'm imagining this microtubule in the middle of this chamber as my patient. And so the patient's breathing air and oxygen, and we introduce a little anesthesia, a low concentration, and then increase the concentration and keep measuring the super radiance, the quantum optical effects, and hopefully it will go down, and it'll go down and down as we increase the concentration. And then we decrease the concentration and turn the gas off, and we hope to see the super radiance return to normal to show that it's reversible. Just like when I put my patients to sleep and then turn off the gas and wake them up, they're exactly as they were before. So that's what we're hoping for. We also hope to try psychedelics and see the hypothesis is that the psychedelics would increase the super radiance, just like their consciousness is enhanced on a psychedelic. You could say it's hallucinations, you could say it's enhanced, however you want to describe it, but it's clearly expansive in some way. And then going back to the gases, we have a number of different gases and they all have different potency. So if you have one anesthetic that is twice as potent as the other, the potent one you would need, we would predict, you would need half as much of a concentration as the other to get the same effect. So the different anesthetics all have different concentrations and we have 10 of them or more we can use. And we would do this dose response curve and find the average concentration at which there's 50% reduction in the superradiance, and then compare that to the known potency of putting you, I, or any animal to sleep. And if the potency in dampening the superradiance in the microtubule correlates with their known potencies in putting humans and animals to sleep, then I think we have a good argument that this is the mechanism of consciousness, because no other theory really comes anywhere close to this level of detail. If these experiments turn out the way I just said, and hope they do, and we have a good beginning. We've shown dampening from simple anesthetics on the system, and we'll just keep going, hopefully.
Tell us about some opportunities for students in this field.
Well, we just started the educational program. It's funded by the Eugene Zhang Family Foundation to support course development. We hope to add more courses and have an undergraduate minor at the University of Arizona and then eventually a graduate program. As of now, the only students that are actively involved are in Jay Sanguinetti's lab looking at transcranial ultrasound. And they've been doing all kinds of stuff, looking at effects on mood, effects on induced mindfulness, working with Shinzen Yang. Shinzen found a particular area in the posterior cortex that can induce the mindfulness state. Most recently, we've been looking at ultrasound to the vagus nerve in the neck, just a handheld device, which looks like enhances mood. And we checked effect on heart rate to make sure we're not. So it increases heart rate variability, but doesn't affect heart rate in any way. And we hope to look at that also for gastrointestinal problem, irritable bowel syndrome and stomach problems and various GI problems. Our gastroenterology people are interested in that.
What other disciplines do you think are interested in consciousness studies?
Consciousness studies is so diverse and so interdisciplinary that it touches almost everything. It's not just philosophy. It's not just neuroscience. It's almost everything. Buddhist studies, Native American studies, philosophy, pretty much everything.
You mentioned nanotechnology as well.
Yes, nanotechnology, definitely. Because, you know, we get down to microtubules, we're in nanotechnology land.
Do you think if your results with the ultrasound machines continue to be so impressive that eventually people will start using them to cure some of the diseases that you mentioned in today's program, like Alzheimer's or, for example, schizophrenia?
Ultrasound machines are relatively inexpensive and they're safe. And we'll see. It's painless. It seems very safe if you lose it at low intensity. The problem is that nobody makes any money out of it. You know, the drug companies make so much money out of all the pharmaceuticals.
Maybe you can have a startup that makes ultrasound machines.
Well, there are startups. Let's just put it that way.
Hi, you've been listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Thank you so much for joining us today. And we would like to thank our guest, Dr. Stuart Hameroff, very much for his time and for this interview. If you would like more information about the upcoming The Science of Consciousness conference, which will be taking place from April 18 to 22nd in Tucson, Arizona, please visit consciousness.arizona.edu. And if you'd like a copy of today's interview, please download it from our website, moderntechnews.com. That's moderntechnews.com.